And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your regular host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It is Easter Sunday, April 4th, 2021. And that is Bob Marley, of course, singing songs of freedom, redemption songs. And our life, our struggle is really one redemption song, reclaiming the earth and beginning with our own minds and hearts. That's why we built the Republic of Canada. That's why we do all of this work. We're here every Sunday. Follow our work, republicofcanada.ca. Well, Easter, that's another good word and practice that was ripped off by the Church of Rome, because Easter is actually a practice of my Gaelic ancestors. The Saxon Gaelic peoples of Europe believed in a big bunny. He was a rabbit, who invisible rabbit. He would fly through the sky, and his name was Easter. And when he breathed out, he would cause the spring blossoms to start budding on all the trees. Isn't that beautiful? That kind of connection, understanding our ancestors had, but we're connected to all things, and the life breath comes from all of us, the God incarnate within all of us. Now, today we are going to talk about that, but we're also going to talk about it in a very specific context of, as Bob Marley said, redemption. Moving from death to birth, that's supposed to be what this season is all about. And today's show I'm called The Death Throes of the Beast on the Way to the Kingdom of Heaven. I don't say Kingdom of Heaven. We don't believe in kings, after all. The Kingdom of Heaven means we're a new family. We're a new people called out of the old world into a new one. And the amazing thing is, folks, is that I've yet again had another experience in my life of how that reality has already arrived among us. And all we have to do is live in that new reality, and we automatically negate the old. The most recent proof I have of that is something that you've all received, which you can see at republicofcanada.ca under Breaking News. And that is, yesterday, I was notified by an email. Of course, it could be a bogus email, who knows. But it notifies that I have to isolate myself for 14 days or I'll go to jail because I recently returned to the country. Now, this is a very odd thing to say because I haven't gone anywhere. And people, my friends and allies and comrades, all said, well, it's obviously the government trying to take you down with a bogus email and locking away, Kev. And I, you know, that's possible. Very possible. But I did some thinking about this, and I realized something else that had been going on. And that is, I am presently in an area, and I don't want to say where, which has been officially reclaimed by a Republic of Canada as no longer being under Crown Law jurisdiction. And we released that statement to the feds months ago, because in conjunction with a certain Indigenous nation, we declared publicly that we're no longer part of Canada. I'm in that area. Now, to leave that area and go back into, quote, Canada means, yes, you've come back into the country, because I certainly didn't go into the United States or anywhere else. But I went from one area of our Republic of Canada back into what's called Canada. And so, they are admitting that we exist. They've acknowledged our jurisdiction. They just don't want all of you to know it. That, in fact, by declaring independence, not just as an individual, but as a group, we are establishing that among us. And that, to me, is an example of our power. Not that I'm under attack or anything, because that's just smoke and mirrors to get people afraid, and I'm not afraid of them. What it is a recognition that we have sovereignty. We have actual jurisdiction. It's an amazing revelation, and it's relevant to what's going on today here as well. Because the date today is very significant. 7 years ago today, on Easter Sunday 2014, I stood outside the oldest Catholic church outside Italy, the oldest one in the world, in Maastricht, Holland, and we declared a global emancipation proclamation. And I'm going to get into that in the second part of the show, but I want to just mention briefly that in this emancipation proclamation, we officially nullified the legal and spiritual church of power of the Church of Rome. We told the officials of that church to stand down. We nullified their authority and all of their statutes and released all of their employees and adherents from any oath of allegiance to the Pope or anybody, and gave sheriffs and peace officers the right to seize Catholic Church property, arrest those we found guilty of genocide and child murder, and free people generally from the influence. Well, that was 7 years ago at Easter. And what was really interesting, here's another example of our power. Part of that, let me read it. All Church of Rome officials and agents, including Jorge Bergoglio, so-called pontiff of the Church of Rome, every cardinal of the Roman Curia, and Adolfo Pichon, chief superior of the Jesuit order, are hereby ordered to immediately stand down from and relinquish their offices. Well, guess what Adolfo Pichon did 1 month later, folks? He announced his resignation. 1 month after we declared this publicly on April 20th, 2014, on May 20th, he steps down. He announces his resignation. No Jesuit leader had ever done that in the history of the Jesuit Church. And guess what? 6 years later to the day, May 20th, 2020, he dies in Tokyo. So look at the dates. April 20th, the proclamation is made. May 20th, he resigns. May 20th, 6 years later, he dies. These things are not coincidences, folks. They're a sign of our growing power. And the second half of the show, I'm going to get into that more, but people are being clamoring to know more of the details of what really is behind this latest move by Bill Blair, who is the minister responsible for COVID enforcement and borders and the RCMP and police. He's basically the top cop for all of Canada. And his agency issued this imprisonment order to me, this demand that I self-isolate on the basis of nothing. It was really interesting because this week, our Republic of Canada was to open a grand jury investigation into Bill Blair and two other guys, good old Justin Trudeau, and Richard Wagner, who is actually the official head of state now in Canada. And this is part of a whole bigger issue, which I want to touch on for a few minutes, which people probably don't know about. Richard Wagner took over as acting governor general from a woman called Julie Payette. And Richard Wagner now is called the administrator for Canada. He runs everything. The buck stops with him. He's the chief justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. And he's also the governor general, which means he's the judicial and executive branch all rolled into one person. Absolute dictatorship. And in a nutshell, what happened was in January, he replaced Julie Payette because Julie Payette, the governor general, and Justin Trudeau had both been named in an international court indictment after Trudeau acknowledged in June 2019 that genocide had occurred in Canada. The two of them were summoned to appear before an international court. Trudeau ignored it, but Julie Payette didn't. She was very upset. There was a lot of dissension. And she said, basically, and we know this from insiders, that she wanted to respond to the summons and go. Well, Trudeau wanted her out. At that point, she was forced out, and this Richard Wagner took over. Only problem is, Richard Wagner is a loyal Crown adherent. You know, he works for the British Crown. Justin Trudeau doesn't. He works for Beijing. We know more and more the evidence that section of the Canadian ruling class are going with China rather than England. So Trudeau and Bill Blair are on the pro-China lobby, and they're in conflict with Richard Wagner. And that conflict is really determining a lot of what's going on, because here's what's happened in a nutshell. Trudeau realizes the need to co-opt any move towards a republic. We already have the support of two-thirds of the people in Canada, according to recent polls. So as they've always done, including with the genocide issue, they're attempting to co-opt the whole movement for a republic. They are planning to announce sometime over the next 6 months to a year the creation, the severing of ties with the Crown and the creation of a republic. What they mean by that, they won't even use the word republic. They're going to install a president to replace the governor general, nullify the oath of allegiance to the Crown. But in order to do that, they've got to nullify us. They've got to destroy any legitimate move to have a republic. So what's been going on over the last few months is we've had groups cropping up around Canada, especially in Vancouver, where it seems to be centered, not surprisingly, because this is the area where China is most trying to influence and take over, and where they've destroyed a lot of our assemblies on Vancouver Island. In Vancouver, there's a group that's been set up that claims to be the Republic. They've denounced me, they've broken off ties with the Republic, and they say, no, we're the Republic. So it's the usual kind of divide and conquer tactics. But this is part of the move of the federal government to try to co-opt a genuine Republic movement, countering the traditional Crown element around Richard Wagner. And they're in open conflict. Now, this is kind of like what goes on in the Vatican between Bergoglio, kind of the 2030 agenda pope, the new globalist pope, versus Ratzinger, who's still alive, and he's the old kind of traditionalist, Italian mob cardinal faction in the Vatican. Same kind of split going on in Canada. And so this is really behind why Bill Blair went after me and is continuing to go after me. I do think, like I said before, it's an acknowledgement lawfully that we have our own sovereignty. We just have to assert it. But it's really interesting that they're keeps going after me right now because Bill Blair is named in the indictment of our grand jury that's convening, has already convened this coming week. And the grand jury came about because one of our organizers in Ontario, as you know from previous shows, was arrested, confined illegally, tortured in prison, and as a result is bringing an application against Bill Blair and others for that. Well, we were about to serve summonses on Bill Blair. He thought he beat us to the punch by issuing this against me and others. There's other similar things coming down on other leaders of the Republic of Canada, which we can get into in future shows. But this is really what's behind it all. So I find it really fascinating that we're having such an impact. Now, let me just comment on that, because actually at the half-hour break, I want to play a sermon I did last year, which has to do with a lot of kind of a spiritual reflection on what things we're talking about and the meaning of rebirth from my own personal experiences, but working with Native people and others. But before that, I wanted to just look a little bit more about what's going on. We know this stuff happened in response to the indictment of Trudeau and Julie Payette, the power struggle going on in Ottawa between the pro-Crown and pro-China lobbies. And nevertheless, we can't lose sight of the fact that this is all in response to the initiatives we're taking. Just like it was with the movement to disestablish Canada because of its genocide, we had a movement that had to struggle for 15 years before that we got the truth of genocide exposed, and it was directly in response to the handful of us who were leading this. Similarly now, it doesn't take many of us to spark this reaction because we have a great power on our side, which we're going to talk about in the second half of the show. But in that sense, in July 2nd to 4th, there's a national convention of the Republic of Canada, its first constitutional convention. Now, Trudeau and Bill Blair and that faction are really panicking because they have to get this in place before we do our constitutional convention, because at that point, we're the established republic and they know it. So over the next 3 months, you're going to see a lot of these kind of attacks. And I just have to share this. This is hilarious. We normally don't get responses when we send things out to people. But there's a Senator, Larry Campbell, and he actually responded to us. And I had a really kind of a funny email exchange with him. I want to share it. We sent him a copy of the media announcement about the attempt to imprison me. And Larry Campbell writes back, "Take me off your list." So I write back to Larry, "Hi, Larry. We really have to do lunch sometime. You're a treat, of course." Larry Campbell writes back, "I drink poison first." I write back, "Oh, Larry, don't do that. We need you to testify." Larry writes back, "Enough of your madness. Go away." And I write back, "Not madness, just crows coming home to roost, brother." Now, the reason, you could tell that panicked tone in his email. The reason he's panicked is he's personally implicated in what went on at Piggy's Palace, the Picton frame-up, the frame-up of Willie Picton to take the fall over a snuff film trafficking and murder industry that was going on in Coquitlam out of Piggy's Palace. Larry Campbell was named by cops and women on the street as somebody who took part in that. Larry Campbell is a former cop, coroner of Vancouver, interestingly enough, mayor of Vancouver, and now he's a senator appointed a number of years ago. And guess what? One of his best buddies is Bill Blair, because they're both cops. And it's interesting, Bill's on the hot seat now, and Larry's reacting this way. So I think, again, this is an example of you keep probing the beast. It's like Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, you have to continue to probe the enemy to find its responses and its weaknesses. Well, that's what we're doing now. But in that sense, yes, we are having this big impact. And they will strike out at some of us. But the more they do that, the more it helps us. You know, they know they can't come out and openly arrest me, because it'll just draw a lot more attention. I've already had offers from two countries who are offering me political asylum. We have human rights observers coming to Canada to support our work. They're going to be more and more in the hot seat. So for them to come back at us with more repression would be really stupid, even for them. But here's the reality. The problem isn't with them. The problem is the human beings in our movement, the men and women who believe in the Republic and yet don't seem ready to take that step yet. Many who pledge their citizenship to the Republic quickly fall away or they even turn against us and start self-sabotaging the movement we're doing. Now, you could say, oh, they're put up to do it, they're influenced to do it. It's a very human reaction, though. People are not ready, by and large, to accept a new world. They have to find that willingness in themselves to change and to change the things in themselves that are holding that new, that newness, that spring, spiritual springtime that's going to build a new republic. Because that's really what a republic is. It's a called out group of people. It's not even for a majority. It's for those who realize they have to reclaim their lives and hence their nation. So, yeah, we can talk about the need to really ramp it up now and expand the republic, do more citizenship training, form more local cells, assemblies, and all the other things you can read about at republicofcanada.ca. But these actions will only be possible if there's that inner renewal and facing our fears and facing these realities. Now, here's the other thing. What we're facing now, this so-called COVID situation, it's not really a virus. It's really coming from within us. It's not a judgment coming from the invisible avenging hand of God. It's the outcome of choices we have made as a people. This present tyranny hasn't been imposed on us. It's arisen from among we ourselves. That muzzled, faceless, regimented population you see around you every day, that's the physical and outward manifestation of who we've become as a people, as individuals who are part of a murderous, genocidal machine that's conquered our planet. Haven't we all funded and supported that machine and lived off its bloody fruit? Haven't we all turned our thoughts and hearts away from the proven crimes in our midst? I mean, where were all of us when the cattle trucks and rail cars were carting off generations of little children to be tortured and sterilized and raped and then thrown in mass graves after being killed in the Christian death camps they still call residential schools? Schools that were just down the road from our own neighborhoods. Didn't we pay the taxes and church offerings that funded that mass murder? Don't we continue to ignore its survivors and the mass graves of those children all over the country? How many of us have actively put anything on the line for those victims and protested the genocide with the same passion we now have about our own loss of freedom from the COVID police state? We can abhor the forced vaccinations that are coming down on us, but where were we when the same vaccinations were being imposed on Native people over the last 150 years in Canada? So are we surprised that this monstrous machine is now turning on us? It's not God's judgment. It's the consequence of our own history and our decisions. Well, that's the reality, and we can't go back to the murderous crime we once called our home because its time is over. There is no going back. We have now two choices, a new society of tyranny, the corporatocracy, in which democracy, the rule of law is gone. We see that every day. Or we have a new possibility, a new world opening up through a covenant, a new covenant with the Creator, with creation, with one another that we call a sovereign republic. Because the blood-soaked city we all call civilization is falling. It's taking down its false churches. It's taking down any of us who continue to cling to it in our minds, our hearts, or religions. Well, it took me many years to discover that I was sent here as a watchman on the tower to announce to my own people the coming of this disaster. I didn't realize that I'd also be presiding over the funeral of my own people after vainly trying to expel the demonic spirit that possesses them. But even though I sounded the warning of that coming judgment, I was ignored. I'm still ignored and pilloried all the time. But that judgment has arrived anyway. And we call this land the land of no one. And that's unfortunately what we have become. We have occupied a land where there are no people left. They're trying to turn us all into dead components of the machine. And that is why it is now make or break time. We have to reclaim our hearts and minds first from this machine. When you get a notice in the mail, you must quarantine. It's like the central authority saying, you are being watched, and there will be a consequence if you do that, if you don't obey. We find time and again when we ignore that and push through it and defy them, they fall back because it's all built on illusion. I had to learn this the hard way through many years of loss, but with every loss, I persisted and learned. And that's one of the things that makes my story unique in that I've acquired this knowledge. It's one of the reasons they continually try to isolate and marginalize me because they don't want the lessons shared. But I've seen the transformation that happens up close when people are earn the right to be free by suffering and continue to suffer through their losses and yet come out and continue to fight at the other end. That's part of what I've learned. Now, I want to share that in the, I've been sharing that in the context of what's been going on in this world. In the next section, I want to talk about the spiritual consequences of that and how we can be led towards a new kind of covenant at that level, as well as our 3D level. Before I do that, I want to share a reflection I gave last year, actually, December 2019, I did a reflection, and it was called An Outcast Victory, The World Turned Upside Down. We're going to listen to that now, and I'll be back after that.
Hi, everyone. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice again. I'm giving you today a sermon for the third Sunday in Advent. That's the upcoming Sunday, December 15th, 2019. And this is part of an ongoing series called God's Revolution, a radical reading of Scripture for refugees from false religion. It's sponsored by the Covenanters, a separatist political and spiritual movement. Today's gospel was taken from Luke chapter 1, verses 46 to 55. It's sometimes called Mary's Song of Praise, announcing the birth of Jesus, or the Magnificat. But I call today's sermon An Outcast's Victory, The World Turned Upside Down. And when you read Mary's words, and you go back to the original Greek, once again, you get a very different message from what you see printed in the Bible. Mary's words are, "My soul grows and rejoices, for in my poverty I am chosen to do great things. Because of me, rulers are pulled down from their thrones and destroyed, and the lowly are raised up and exalted. The hungry are filled with all that is good, and the rich are banished and sent away empty." Well, all of this reminded me of a woman named Karen Connerly. Karen was someone who people tried not to notice, especially in church. She was poor and bedraggled. She was Aboriginal and pregnant, and she was barely 16 years old. On the morning we met, Karen stood tentatively on the edge of our congregation with a look of what I thought at the time was fear. In fact, she had arrived that day to overturn our world. At the time, I had been the minister of St. Andrew's United Church in Port Alberni for barely a year, and my life seemed wonderful, content and happy. Our Port Alberni congregation had tripled in size, and everyone seemed quite content. They were especially delighted on Sundays when my little infant daughter, Eleanor, used to toddle to the front of the service during my sermon and insist that I pick her up. So I'd stand there and preach with Eleanor in my arms, and that delighted especially the elderly ladies in the congregation. Now, at the time, in my joy, I couldn't imagine how that was all about to change forever. Well, when Karen Connerly appeared that Sunday in our church in the fall of 1993, it didn't really alarm a lot of us at first because a few local Indians had already begun to attend the service. The local New Chelmuth Indians had begun to accept my invitation to come to church, but they were mostly affluent natives. They were tribal council people, and they kept to themselves, which pretty much suited my white parishioners just fine. As for me, I was feeling pretty proud of myself that I had been able to seat Indians alongside whites, which was the first in our church, and to have Indians and whites sitting together on Sundays. It was also a first anywhere in Port Alberni. Even though at the time, despite feeling that pride, I didn't know the conditions, the homegrown slaughter that my own church had perpetrated on the local natives that was responsible for that ongoing apartheid in our community. Well, Karen Connerly changed all of that. She did it in the way anyone does who is living on the edge and can't afford to hide the truth by being polite or considerate. Well, I knew something was afoot when Karen walked into the church, and she didn't sit down with the rest of us after our opening hymn. She stood at the back of the sanctuary and just stared at me. One of the ushers went up and spoke to her, but she shook her head and barked something that made heads turn. I was weighing what to do when suddenly she began shuffling towards me at the front of the church, and even before her wailing began, I could see that she was crying. Her words rocked the church. She cried out, "They killed my baby! They killed my little Charlie!" Well, at that point, an usher named George Geddes got up, and he went over to the woman and actually put her in an arm lock. And the congregation exploded at that point in cries and shouts of outrage. Of course, I didn't know if they were outraged at what she was doing or what George was doing to her. Anyway, she tried to wrestle free, but another guy got up grabbed her as well. And at that point, I just came down out of the pulpit. I heard to them because I was dumbstruck that men that I thought I knew were perpetrating such sudden violence on this little Indian woman. I got the ushers to back off. I guided Karen to an empty pew, and I sat her down. And then I asked everyone around me to just sit down and calm down. Well, Karen then poured out her story to me. She described what had happened. And people sat in a stony silence while others got up and hurried out of the church. I was advised later by my board that I should have let George and his buddies manhandle the inconvenient Indian out of church so that the service could have continued in peace. But even then, as obtuse as I was, I knew that something else, something more important was at work than just church business as usual. Karen Connerly was a single mother. She lived on welfare in the Midtown slum area of Puerto Bernie that's still called the ghetto. It's where mostly Indians live. She'd been raped by her father and by uncles at the local Seychad Indian Reservation, and so she lived in hiding in the ghetto with her one-year-old son, Charlie, and her newborn daughter, the one who was not yet born in her womb. One day, little Charlie began to cough uncontrollably, and soon he turned blue and went into convulsions. So in a panic, Karen carried him up to West Coast General Hospital and asked for their help. But the emergency room staff turned Charlie away. I was appalled when I heard that. I was oblivious to the emptying pews around me. I was just focused on Karen. I said, "What, you mean they wouldn't help him?" She shook her head and said, "They just let him die." The nurse said, "They don't treat Indians." Well, after that, Karen sat with the corpse of her little boy at a bus stop near the hospital. She sat there till morning until a Mountie found her and actually arrested her, and then she was charged with manslaughter in the death of her own son. No one believed that it was the hospital that had killed Charlie. "It's how they treat us here," Karen explained after she calmed down a bit. "It's always been that way for us, but they're not going to kill this one," she said, and she patted her swollen belly. Well, everything changed after that day. For me, especially, the thrones in my mind began to topple for me. I opened my heart and my door to many more of Karen's people and to the legions of other murdered Indian children that still lie in unmarked graves up at the United Church Alberni Indian Residential School. And that change spread from me and around me. It eventually began a political and a spiritual firestorm across Canada and across the world that's begun to overthrow a genocidal church and state system and turn everything upside down. Well, many centuries ago, there lived a woman a lot like Karen Connerly. She too was unwed, poor, outcast. She too was pregnant with a child. And with a revolution, a new presence in the world that would make the last first and the first last. That woman's name, of course, was Mary, and she was chosen to bring Jesus the Christ into the world. Well, today's gospel reading from Luke chapter 1 speaks of that revolution. It's often called the Magnificat. Unfortunately, the Christian church has surrounded this tale with a lot of cultic imagery and belief about a so-called virgin mother of God. But Mary was not a virgin. The church only calls her that because of a Latin mistranslation of the Greek word for young woman, very young woman, because Karen was a teenager, so was Mary. They were likely very young. Mary was as poor and as human as Karen Connerly, and as human as Jesus himself. Mary's song of praise that we read in today's gospel reading, is like John the Baptist's announcement that we heard last week about the coming of Jesus. This song of praise is intended to prepare people for Christmas and the imagined Bethlehem birth narrative, but once again, myth gets in the way of fact. Because as we know, Christmas has nothing to do with Christianity. December 25th was the Roman festival called Saturnalia, otherwise known as the time for reversal. For on that day, the slave owners would take off their robes and be the servant to their slaves, who would become the masters, for the day at least. That's no accident. The same great reversal, the turning of the world upside down, is at the core of Mary's song of praise. By naming Saturnalia as Jesus' birthday, the earliest Christians were saying, this is the consequence of the justice that Jesus has ushered into the world. All the rulers are pulled down, and the poor everywhere are raised. Now, pull down, that phrase in Greek, The Greek word for that is katareo, which means to utterly destroy, to obliterate, so they're not there anymore. Rulers of one over another, the rule of one man over another, is obliterated. Well, clearly by that, it's obvious that a radically new world is coming into being for a purpose not so obvious at first. It's often been said that the best way to tame a revolutionary idea is to turn it into a religion. Well, that's certainly happened with Christianity, because if you merely worship someone, you don't have to take them seriously. And so the radical message of Jesus of human equality and liberation was quickly contained and mythologized by the wealthy corporate church of Rome into a cult ritual that really smothered the power of Jesus' words and message. That religious cult killed the memory and spirit of Jesus and made him a sacrificial atonement for so-called human sin, a heresy called Roman Catholicism that, like all worldly empires, creates shame and humiliation in people in order to control them. But that degrading spirit is the opposite of what we hear today in Mary's triumphant song of praise. Her song is imbued with a force that breaks apart oppression and elevates humanity above itself. It shows us that even in our loneliness, we are chosen to fulfill a higher purpose and remake the world according to divine justice. Well, not surprisingly, as you can imagine, I used to get in trouble with my staid theology professors about this gospel reading. Its revolutionary message was not obvious to them as it was to me. In fact, it frightened my profs because, like Jesus' overturning of the money changers in the Jerusalem temple, it was outside their experience and went against their perceived interests. Richard Leggett was a particularly fat theologian who taught me Bible studies, and he used to get mad at me. He'd say, no, these texts can't be taken literally. Mary didn't literally mean the rich when she said they were sent away hungry. It's a spiritual allegory. She meant anyone who's inwardly impoverished. And toppling rulers from the throne, well, that's just a reference to Satan, not to earthly rulers. Well, I remember answering him, well, then how about when Jesus says that a rich man can no more enter heaven than a camel can pass through the eye of a needle? Doesn't that mean it's impossible for the rich to go into heaven? Well, Big Dick smiled at me smugly, always quick with an answer, and he said, no, the eye of the needle refers to a little-known gate in Jerusalem. It's small, but you can still crawl through it if you try. How convenient. And on ad nauseum. Over the years, I've learned that belief for most Christians is determined not by their faith as much as by their salary and pension plan. Fortunately, Jesus didn't have either. Well, to illustrate all this and to go deeper in today's gospel message, let's examine its key words from Luke chapter 1, verses 46 to 55, if you want to follow along. Mary's first words in this passage are telling. She says, my soul magnifies the Lord. Well, the words in Greek for soul is psyche, which means substance or breath. And the word for magnifies is megaluno, which means to declare or to make greater or better. My soul magnifies the Lord seems to be saying that Mary herself is somehow making God better. She's making God more than God. Mary is the subject of the sentence. God is the object. Mary is acting upon God and perhaps on the godness within herself. But then the rest of the passage seems to reverse that. It has Mary saying that God is choosing her to bring down the mighty and elevate the poor despite their lowly status. But this is ultimately Mary's song, and the first words situate Mary as the cause of everything that follows. It's amazing. Well, let's avoid the temptation of interpreting that meaning to somehow cultify Mary into godlike status as the Church of Rome has done. In fact, what's being described in Luke 1:46 is fully human and reveals the majesty of being fully human. If there is divine greatness in our world, it is because of the courage and the witness of the human soul. The mystery called God has taken flesh in every child born and awaits like a seed in us to flower into the life of one like Jesus, who by being fully human was fully divine. Well, when you think about it, it's an incredible revelation. It puts an end to religion and to the world as we know it, where we're expected to always defer to some other authority figure and wait upon salvation and meaning to be delivered by somebody else. That evolution away from that childhood notion into godness within, understanding of our wider place in the world. That evolution is evident when you simply read through the Bible, the way it progresses. I mean, isn't it evident from a complete reading of the Bible that we are already in a direct and unmediated relationship and partnership with the great mystery that we call God? Because as it progresses, God, the idea, the impression of God, and perhaps the nature of God changes. He evolves from a vengeful, judgmental ruler into a state of unconditional love. Well, in the same way that that child matures from self-absorption and understanding, our soul journey as a people is bringing to birth a better divinity through our willingness to accept the risk and the cost of being human, of existence. The mystery grows and evolves through us as we become more than ourselves. The ancient Greek writers and the person who authored the book of Job depict how man rises above God by persevering in the truth, whatever the cost, despite our mortality, despite our weakness. The Greek playwright Aeschylus wrote, "The gods look with envy upon man because, although living for but a day, he surpasses the Olympians by still daring to love and to be valiant." It's beautiful. And it's all true. Like Karen Connerly and every woman who courageously brings forth life into a world of suffering and death, Mary sings in triumph because she knows that whatever comes, she's created a chance for all of us, the possibility of a new world where the old corruption is toppled. And perhaps her particular joy was to know that her own son would bring about that new way by lighting a fire and a sacred spirit in humanity that would never go out. Karen Connerly's New Chelmneth people have a story that once Christ visited their West Coast tribes, many centuries before the whites ever appeared. The Christ, who came to them as a woman, warned the New Chelmneth that a pale people would come to their land carrying her name and words, but they would lack her inner spirit, her teachings. The teaching that said that all of God's creatures were to be loved and respected and treated equally. Well, the Christ told the New Chelmneth that the pale Christians had lost that soul, and so they were to welcome them and lead them back to her true way. The New Chelmneth tried to do so, and they were slaughtered for it, just like Jesus was. But as with him, that spirit cannot be killed by cannon fire or smallpox or by big money. That promise rests within all of us. It's immortal. It waits to be born fully human and remake our world by first turning upside down everything inside us and around us. Well, the week after I was fired by the United Church for uncovering its crimes against her people, Karen Connerly came back. She appeared in my church one final time. She had heard what had happened to me, and she came there to support me. But when she saw that I was no longer there in the pulpit, she stood up in the service, and she declared, "You're crucifying Kevin just like you did us, but God sees what you're doing, and you're going to come down." And at that point, Karen again was grabbed and finally, like me, evicted from St. Andrew's United Church. And soon after that, she was found dead. But crucifixions have never ended anything. What Karen predicted has come true, for by her courage, she has birthed it into being. The rulers are falling, the dead churches are collapsing, and the silenced victims are standing up and speaking and reclaiming the world. Well, I've seen this revolutionary miracle. I know it to be true because I've helped birth it into being. I pray for all of you that you may come to know and give life to the same Magnificat, the divine word taken flesh among us, to topple the ruler of this world and to bring to being a new creation. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Remember, live it. Thank you.
And we're back. So there. Well, you know, folks, it's not abstract for me. It's been lived. And I never planned on this. I never expected any of this to happen. And like life, for any of us, we take it as it comes. We try to be consistent, upright at all times. Doesn't always work, but we keep going. And that's the important thing. This is a difficult day for me. April 4th, a number of things happened. 25 years ago today, this is the day that I was ordered out of my own home by a court order that the United Church and my ex-wife, Ann McNamee, came up with to rob me of my children. So this was actually the last day in 1996 that I saw my children on a daily basis. 25 years later, I'm thinking of how much that suffering has opened up my life and brought me to a new place that I was meant to be. It helped me find my purpose and brought life to so many other people. And yet at the cost of my own family, my children and me. You could say, well, would a just God do that? We tend to see God in our terms. There's a term for that in anthropology. We anthropomorphize God. We project our human qualities and failings onto divinity. And we shouldn't do that because the purposes of the divine, of creation, are far beyond our ability to even understand most of the time. And I love that quote. We can never fully understand even the ones we're closest to, but we can love completely. And it's in that love that we find a higher understanding. And so that's been one of the hard lessons in my life, but a liberating lesson. And I don't know how to impart this to people. You know, when we have our meetings, I try to kind of come to where people are at and explain things, and they still don't get it. I realize all I can do is witness by my life, and maybe people will experience from their own life what I'm talking about. But here's some of the things that I realize on this date. It was interesting, too. April 4th was the day Martin Luther King was assassinated. And like I said, 7 years ago today, Easter Sunday 2014, we proclaimed this Global Emancipation Proclamation, told the two popes, the Bergoglio and Pashon, the Jesuit and the so-called regular pope, told them both to stand down. I don't believe Bergoglio, so-called Pope Francis, was just a hand puppet anyway, but the actual power behind the throne, the Jesuit, the so-called black pope, he stepped down a month later in direct response to this, because what was being invoked wasn't just a guy standing outside a church in Maastricht. I was a channel for something. And the same way when I did the first exorcism outside the Vatican on October 11, 2009, and then a tornado hits the next morning in Rome, and then that week the first news of Pope Benedict's involvement in covering up child trafficking and killing in his own church break into the European media. That's all a power working through me. And I realized I had to be emptied before that power could work through me. I had to be stripped of all of my own hopes, human illusions, priorities, all the things that normally held us back from doing the divine will, that had to go out the window. I had to be, that part of me had to die before something else could be born. And for me, that's a metaphor, an example of what happens to those of us who have been chosen and set aside to do this work. And it's not for most people. And that's what a hard thing I've had to learn is that it isn't for most people. You know, we can lead by example, but ultimately there's that long, I think somebody once called it a long loneliness. Of people who do know that they've been set aside for a certain purpose. It can never be communicated to another any more than we can really communicate love and our own integrity to another in words or even touch. It's got to be lived. And hopefully the person understands us the more we live it purely and absolutely. But I mentioned the whole thing about the Global Emancipation Proclamation because it came out of a whole chain of events and things that are still playing themselves out, including this latest stuff with Bill Blair and the COVID police state and all of this nonsense. It's all the manifestation of something because there were three exorcisms that occurred aimed at the heart of this problem. And of course, we're aiming at the source of the evil in this world, in Rome, where historically a lot of this stuff comes from and spiritually it still emanates from. And when the source collapses, everything else falls apart. And we've been witnessing that since Easter 2014. We have been seeing something quite amazing in the world. And of course, we're meant to just look at all the bad stuff so we become overwhelmed and demoralized. But what's really going on is a separation, an enormous spiritual and political separation between the corporatocracy, which is the manifestation literally of Satan in this world, the machine corporatocracy trying to reduce us all to component parts, unthinking, inhuman, dehumanized components of a satanic machine. And then on the other side, the natural law of God that's born in us, that manifests in our common law assemblies and our republics, in love and solidarity between each other, in our willingness to die and in the defense of our children, all of that, the other force in the world. And there is a spiritual civil war going on right now between those two forces. And we each have to choose, and are often that choice is made for us by who we are. We have to choose where we stand in that now. There is no more middle ground. We recognize in the course of that that there is a remnant put aside to lead that. And my ancestors in Scotland, in when they broke from the Church of Rome, the Church of England, they fought kings and popes both. And not surprisingly, their people went on to found the American Republic. The Scots-Irish were the main leadership of the American Revolution and the Continental Army because they recognized that the kingdom, a true republic, is not of this world, not of princes or parliaments or popes or kings or anyone, but of the divine will and the natural law within all of us. John Adams said, America is unique in history. It is the first nation in the world where people govern themselves within their own conscience and the laws from that conscience. And that's a choice we each need to make. Are we willing to govern ourselves? Because if so, we have to lose something of ourselves first. We have to lose these false attachments to this false world. I've seen so many people in a republic movement fall away and suddenly hate me with a vengeance overnight when, an example of Vancouver, the people in one of the Vancouver groups that I worked with literally took me out to dinner, birthday dinner, once. And next thing I know, they're attacking me. They're attacking me and calling me names and surfacing all the old RCMP smears from 20 years ago in this really mediocre manner, trying to destroy me and what I'm doing. But I realize it's not aimed at me at all. It's really aimed at themselves because they hated what they were doing. They're still owned by this spirit. And there's this self-destruct mechanism. I've seen it in residential school survivors. As soon as they get too close about telling the truth, they destroy themselves. They commit suicide. They turn on me or others who are helping them bring out the truth. And they hate the best part of themselves because they're still caught up in that machine mind. Well, that's the reality we face spiritually when we engage in this. And that's why I urge you all to read one of the things you should read. We've only got 5 minutes left here, but I want to leave one of these things with you. Psalm 149. This was the psalm invoked by the parliamentarians, the covenanters in England, in Scotland, when they executed the king and established the first biblical republic. And it said, let the high acts of God be in the mouths of the elect and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance upon the mighty and corrections among the people, to bind all kings in chains and the rich with fetters of iron, that they may execute upon them the judgment that is written. This honor shall be that of God's elect. And by that we mean the double-edged sword, it strikes us first. It cuts away our old false life, so we can then be a vehicle of righteousness in the world, and not of ego, and not a political agenda, but of purity. The purity that is struggling to live in all of us all the time and manifest in the world by reclaiming it. But slaves cannot reclaim anything. Slaves cannot reclaim the world if they haven't overcome the slave master in their own mind that makes them attack their own people and help destroy their own assemblies, as we've seen happen all over the republic. But out of that destruction is coming a new seed of people who have learned and have recovered themselves and will not betray one another and try to destroy what we're doing. That's the lesson of the last little while. Now, I want to leave you with that. We've only got a few minutes left. We're going to end with a really wonderful song by Phil Oakes, folk singer from the 60s. The Ballad of the Carpenter says it all. But I want to urge you to tuning in next week. We're going to continue this. We're going to put everything we're talking about in the broader political and spiritual context. And to let you know, and any of you folks listening in from the government or your legal arm or the RCMP or anybody, you're welcomed into the kingdom too. You don't have to be afraid of us. You should be afraid of what you're part of and that part of you that's keeping you locked into a system of evil. We urge you and invite you to come out. Follow our work, republicofcanada.ca, murderbydecree.com, and write to us. Write to me personally, angelfire101@protonmail.com. I want to thank everybody for you've been sending in a really beautiful, supportive emails from me all over the world when you heard what happened and the threats being made against me. But they're not threats. They fall away. They're illusions. Our real power will continue because it's a divine power. People say, how have you survived all this for 25 years, Kevin? It's because I'm working for a higher purpose. And when you do that, you're protected. We know that. And even if I died tomorrow, the work would continue. Because this spirit is eternal. Crucifixions never solved or settled anything. It just allows the resurrection. And that's the message of spring, folks, and the real message of Easter. We are the resurrection. We are the Christ, each one of us, when we accept our full divinity and full humanity. This love and this message goes out to all of you today. Again, write to me at angelfire101@protonmail.com. Stay tuned for more updates at republicofcanada.ca. Brothers and sisters, it's really up to each one of you, but first search your hearts to know that you have to make that choice to come out from death by letting part of you die and letting that eagle rise up in you. And just a final anecdote on that, I was walking in the woods the other day, and out, and you all know my name is Eagle Strong Voice, Gano Geshue Gekido in Cree. Eagle Strong Voice came true the other day because I'm standing there by a bush, and suddenly from under the underbrush hops a bald eagle 10 feet in front of me, and he spreads his wings and flies up into the sky. To me, it was a sign that, Kevin, you got to come out from this underbrush in which you've been struggling for so many years and fly, rise up like eagles on wings, as Isaiah says. Those who trust in the divine will rise up on wings as eagles. That's our message for today. Stay strong. Stay clear. We're back tomorrow and always in our work and next week on our radio show. Thank you, brothers and sisters.